The Biden White House wants more U.S. military support for Ukraine and for Israel. Some say it's absolutely needed.
Think through the world, you know, if the U.S. didn't, we would be encouraging future Russian aggression. We would be encouraging future terrorist attacks against the Jewish state.
Also, the danger of getting news from social media in a time of conflict. And in India, members of one religious minority are renouncing the mainstream lifestyle in favor of strict spiritual austerity.
Especially for women or for young girls, it's almost like an alternative lifestyle, which is available to you without any stigma attached to it.
I'm Marco Werman, and composers who write prehistoric music need just the right materials for their instruments.
It's a ethically sourced moose tibia bone.
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could join us today. President Joe Biden is speaking to the nation tonight in a primetime address from the Oval Office. He just returned from the Middle East, where Israeli troops are poised for what looks like a ground invasion into the Gaza Strip. Some 2 million Palestinians are unsure of their own safety while they try to get by with limited access to water, food, and fuel. Trucks loaded with humanitarian aid supplies are still waiting outside Gaza's border, with Egypt yet to be delivered. President Biden is expected to make the case to the American public for wartime assistance to Israel and to Ukraine. We're going to take some time now to talk about the U.S. role in these two conflicts. Michelle Flournoy served as an Undersecretary of Defense during the Obama administration. Let's talk about the level of U.S. military support here, starting with Israel. What is Washington supplying to the Israeli government, and are you expecting that assistance to rise with an ask from the president?
So, Marco, the U.S. almost immediately began supplying Israel with additional ammunition and replacement interceptors for their Iron Dome anti-missile, anti-rocket system. You know, historically, Israel has never asked for the U.S. to put troops on the ground, but they have asked us to help supply them with materiel and equipment when their stocks run low or when they anticipate them running low. So I'm sure he came back with a laundry list, and that list will be worked through. It'll need congressional authorization and appropriation. And right now, with the chaotic state of the House, that's a problem.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. Just how did the attack by Hamas on October 7th change the calculation for what Israel is asking the U.S. for?
The U.S. has a longstanding relationship with Israel, and we do sell them equipment. But I think what they're doing right now is preparing first and foremost for an intervention in Gaza to try to degrade, if not destroy, the Hamas leadership, their critical infrastructure, their military supplies. But they also have to be prepared for the possibility of a second front opening up with Hezbollah backed by Iran in the north. They need to stock up to make sure they're prepared for that, while they can also protect their population from the thousands and thousands of rockets and missiles that both Hamas and Hezbollah have aimed at Israel.
Yeah, and given Biden's plea to Israel to keep rage in check, how will the U.S. monitor how the weapons are being used?
Well, I think we have a pretty close relationship intelligence-wise and military-wise. We're going to see how these things are used. You know, I do think the Israeli Defense Forces will try to minimize civilian casualties. The problem is Gaza is probably one of the most difficult urban terrains in the world. It's a warren of small buildings, alleyways, booby trapped. So it's an extremely difficult environment. I think that will be the biggest challenge, even if they go in with the right intent.
Now, shifting over to Ukraine, which we're expecting Biden to address tonight as well, the U.S. recently provided new long-range missiles to Ukraine's military. What are the Ukrainians saying they want from the U.S. at this point in the war against Russia?
I think they want continued U.S. supplies and allied country supplies of either things they're running short of, like, you know, artillery shells, or more advanced systems that they may not have purchased previously. You know, Ukraine wants to continue defending itself, continuing to put pressure on Russia, and to hold, if not incrementally advance its position, so that if there are negotiations at some point, they're in a good position. Although, obviously, they're not ready for that yet.
So looking at this $100 billion ask for Israel and Ukraine, if you look at what the U.S. is providing to each country, how does that compare with other military commitments historically?
Well, I think on Ukraine, it's been quite large. I think the Israeli situation will be more comparable to what we've done in the past for Israel when it's been in crisis. The key thing, though, to understand is we are not, in either case, committing troops. Mm. Yes, the president has sent two carrier battle groups to the region. He's put a Marine Corps contingent on alert in case he needs to evacuate Americans. But, you know, he's using a show of force to deter Iran specifically from entering the war with Israel and to be prepared to help with defensive measures against Iran should that occur. In neither case has he committed U.S. troops, nor is he likely to commit U.S. troops. And that's a key difference.
So one thing I need to ask you about, Michelle, is the fact that President Biden campaigned for office, returning often to something he repeated. This is how he said it in 2019.
It's long past time we end the forever wars, which have cost us untold blood and treasure.
Biden wants to end forever wars. I mean, he made the decision to pull the U.S. out of Afghanistan, but these commitments to Ukraine and Israel, I mean, we're looking at two conflicts that many experts agree are open-ended. How can he square his request for military support for two wars that have no end in sight and may be expanding?
Well, you know, again, the distinction is important. These are not wars in which U.S. is committing ground forces, air forces, naval forces to combat. These are both cases where the U.S. has vital interests in helping to provide these partners with the equipment they need to defend themselves. And I think it's absolutely in U.S. interests to provide this. Think through the world, you know, if the U.S. didn't, we would be encouraging future Russian aggression. We would be encouraging future terrorist attacks against the Jewish state in the heartland of the Middle East. I don't think we should conflate commitment of the U.S. military and Americans on the ground with providing support to key partners to defend themselves. And that, I think, is utterly justifiable and shouldn't be thought of as a forever war for the United States.
So as you said, Michelle, congressional support is required for increased military funding in both of these wars. What can the administration do to fulfill commitments to Ukraine and Israel in this political moment? I mean, do Ukrainians and Israelis have to wait until Washington has a Speaker of the House?
Well, they do have some presidential drawdown authority that they can use in both cases. In the case of Israel, under a 10-year memorandum of understanding, in the case of Ukraine, in terms of continuing to expend monies that have already been appropriated. But you're right. At some point, the president needs a new congressional authorization and appropriation. It is one of the reasons why, you know, if the House is unable to elect a new speaker in the short term, it's absolutely imperative to give the speaker pro tem additional authorities to pass emergency legislation of this nature. And I'm hoping that is what will happen if they can't put a speaker in place in the next day or two.
Michelle Flournoy is a former Undersecretary of Defense and the co-founder of West Exec Advisors, helping us understand the challenge the U.S. faces in fulfilling military commitments to both Ukraine and Israel. Michelle, thank you very much for your input.
Thank you.
The ancient faith of Jainism was born in India thousands of years ago. Today, less than 1% of Indians are Jains. They are one of the most educated and wealthiest groups in the country. They also have an unusually high number of people who take strict vows of renunciation. In other words, Jain nuns and monks who choose to lead a life of extreme austerity. Their ultimate goal is to achieve salvation. It's an ancient practice that is still common today. Reporter Sushmita Pathak gives us a glimpse into the lives of these renunciates, as they are known, who are overwhelmingly young women.
At their lavish apartment in Surat in western India, Ami Sangvi and her husband give me a tour of their daughter Devanshi's room.
She only designed her room. Huh?
There's a bed here, then there's a bunk bed. There's a slide also in the room. Wow. And it's all baby pink. Is a very cute color.
Even she choose her bathroom tile, Mama. I just want this colorful tile. This tile choose her.
From the bathroom tiles to the slide, Devanshi picked everything in her room, looking up photos on Pinterest for inspiration. But she never lived here. She never even saw the final look. Because in January, Devanshi, all of 8 years old, renounced the world to become a Jain nun. Her parents show me a video from her initiation ceremony, which they documented on Instagram to demystify the practice. Devanshi has henna patterns on her palms and heavy jewelry around her neck. She looked like a child bride. On the final day of the ceremony, she gave up the finery for a simple white garment, shaved off all her hair, and said her goodbyes. She now lives more than 150 miles away. I'm waiting in front of a Jain upashray. This is where Jain nuns live. It's a simple building. There are white clothes hanging out to dry. This is where Devanshi has been staying, and I'm going to meet her in a few moments. Unfortunately, I won't be able to take my microphone in there because electricity and electronic devices are considered harmful and not allowed inside. Devanshi was shy but looked happy. She was excited for her Sanskrit lesson and told me she wakes up at 5 every morning. Other nuns in the residence are much older than her. The women here are engineers, lawyers, MBAs. Hina Desai is the mother of one of them, who became a nun as an adult.
As a mother, and she being my only child, it was a little difficult for me to, you know, in the beginning, let go of her. But when I realized that eventually she is doing something which is going to make her happy, and so there was no reason for me to say no.
The nuns follow the principle of non-violence, a central tenet of Jainism. They take care not to harm even a small insect. They don't use electricity because they believe generating it harms a lot of living beings. The nuns also strive not to get attached to anything, not even their residence.
They keep moving from one place to another so that there is no feeling of possession. There is no feeling of attachment.
Ruth Pragnashree, a 32-year-old nun, told me that aspects of their life that appear harsh, like plucking out all their hair every 6 months or walking barefoot everywhere, are a way to detach from their physical body. These are not hardships, she said. On the contrary, she found the lives of regular people like me to be more difficult. Just outside the nun's residence, I met Mausam Virvadia, a 25-year-old commerce graduate from Mumbai.
When you stay here now, you get that feel. Kuch to missing hua mere life mein.
She wants to become a nun because she feels there's something missing in her life.
I'm doing everything for others, that's it. And end of the day, I have nothing for myself. Mere atma ke liye kuch nahi hai.
In the regular world, you become so busy looking after others that you don't get time to do anything for yourself, for your soul. You depend on others for joy. But as a nun, your happiness is in your hands, Virvadia says. This autonomy draws a lot of young Jain women toward renunciation, says religious scholar Manisha Sethi.
One should not negate their spiritual yearnings. But having said that, I think, especially for women or for young girls, it's almost like an alternative lifestyle, which is available to you without any stigma attached to it.
Sethi has written a book on Jain nuns, who outnumber monks 4-1. Every nun Sethi met spoke about her independence.
You know, they did not have to wake up and prepare lunches and tiffins for their kids, and you know, they didn't have to pander to the whims of a mother-in-law or a husband and so on. So this sense of autonomy and the sense of control and sense of power.
While hundreds of Jains are initiated each year, it's becoming increasingly rare for children to do so. Child rights groups have raised concerns. Sethi says even within the Jain community, some don't encourage initiation at a very young age. But Devanshi's parents say the criticism is due to ignorance. Jain scriptures allow initiation at 8 years. And in Devanshi's case, her father says it was impossible to dissuade her.
My mother, my sister, my wife, everyone, we questioned different aspects, we discussed, but her maturity was mind-blowing.
Even as a toddler, Devanshi was different, her mom says. Very disciplined, never threw tantrums. And the path of Diksha, Jain asceticism, made sense for her.
She is made for Diksha only.
It's spiritual enjoyment, huh? And she feels that enjoyment.
Devanshi's parents are proud of her, but they still miss her. They can't talk to her on the phone and only get to see her about a couple times a year.
It's my heart, I mean.
She's a piece of my heart, her father says. Devanshi smiles when I tell her this. But when asked if she misses her parents, the 9-year-old nun is quick to respond, no. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Gujarat, Western India.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. As the often misquoted line goes, music has charms to soothe the savage beast. Beasts in this next story are dinosaurs. Two musicians worked on the soundtrack for the BBC series Prehistoric Planet on Apple TV+. To get into the right frame of mind, the composers went to the trouble of inventing prehistoric instruments to help transport viewers back in time. The World's Jerry Haddon has our story.
This is the world's oldest known musical instrument. Archaeologists say Neanderthals made this flute some 60,000 years ago out of a hollow bear bone. And this instrument?
It's a, ethically sourced moose tibia bone.
It was invented by composer Ange Rosman just a couple of years ago. It's called a raptor violin.
With a cello string that we kind of put on top, and then we had to hold it really tightly to actually make a sound. And then this is the actual raptor violin after the prototype. You see it has a tuning peg and everything.
Rosman gives it a whirl. It looks like he's bowing a femur. The sound, when combined with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Rosman says, it transports you. Like in this prehistoric planet scene where a pack of tiny feathered dromaeosauruses pursue prey through the snow.
We never try to overdo it. It's just, it's somewhere there. And we hope that on a subconscious level that would, you know, give the show this otherworldly back in time aspect, just something for the listener to say, ooh, what's that?
The violin raptor is one of the instruments Rosman and partner Kara Talvi created for the series. The inspiration, Talvi says, came out of the blue in a gift shop in the Arizona desert.
We stumbled into this very weird store that was, for some reason, selling fossils and like bones and things of that nature. And we, shortly before that, we had a call with Hans that was basically like, you better come up with something.
Hans being the legendary film composer Hans Zimmer. Rosman and Talvi work for him at his LA studio, Bleeding Fingers.
We needed to come up with something super weird and, you know, try to get inspired and really think outside the box.
The weirdest and coolest instrument, Talvi says, the triceratone. Imagine a cello neck with velociraptor claw tuning pegs. The body of the triceratone is a life-size model skull of a triceratops. To get the percussive sound, you strike its horns with your bow. Talvi sketched out this instrument. Zimmer's master builder then created it.
The triceratone, like, blew me away when I saw it. Like, I thought it was ridiculous. I'm just going to say that. I was like, this is never going to be possible. Like, it's a cool idea, but how are you going to do that? That's so silly, you know? And then I saw it, and I literally lost my breath.
There's also a hadrocello, a petrified wood xylophone, and something called a fat rex, a frame drum that you can play with a toothpick, the tooth being the fossilized fang of a plesiosaurus. Of course, there were no musical instruments 66 million years ago, much less people, but dreaming up the instruments was a way for Rosman and Talvi to get inspired. This project looked way back, but what about musical instruments of the future?
If someone came to you and said, make some instruments because we want to do a movie 1,000 years in the future, you have any idea like where you might find inspiration for looking forward rather than so far back?
Oh, wow. It would have to be something very stylistic.
Yeah, you would have to first tell me if the movie is a happy future of the humankind.
Right.
But based on how things are going, I'll be very surprised if our civilization will exist in the same manner.
Well, we might be back to banging bones together.
Oh, then raptor violin and this is perfect again.
Talvi and Brosman say it's been a lot of work, but they doubt their prehistoric instruments will get much use beyond this project.
So we won't see one of these things pop up on a tour with Bjork or in a K-pop band or something like that.
I mean, if they want to invite us.
Yeah, we won't say no to being on stage with Bjork.
Nor would they say no to taking the stage to accept an Emmy. For the Badlands episode of Prehistoric Planet, they've been nominated for one. For The World, I'm Cherry Hatton.
Now we go to Richmond, not Virginia, but the Richmond just outside of Vancouver in British Columbia. There, Shelley Smith recently noticed something new outside of her home. It was a rock sitting in a field between rows of spinach and bok choy. Then suddenly the rock started to move. The World's Bianca Hillier picks up the story from there.
Smith was, understandably, surprised by the sudden motion.
And I went, wait a minute, rocks don't move on their own?
So she took her German shepherds out to see what was going on.
And that's when I saw him. He was huge, massive.
He isn't a rock at all. He's a sulcata tortoise, native to the Sahara Desert in Africa. And when Smith says he's massive, she means it.
Think turkey. Think you're having 24 people come over for dinner, and you need to put that giant turkey on a giant platter.
Despite his size, Smith says the tortoise was as gentle as could be when she and some nearby construction workers gathered around him.
I know this is a bit of an anthropomorphic view, but he was looking up, you know, looking to the guy who was chatting, and then when I was chatting, he'd look over to me like he was following along in the conversation.
But Smith, a professional dog trainer, knew this animal was out of her league. She called her local society for the prevention of cruelty to animals who came to collect him. He's since been named Frank the Tank, and nearby veterinarian Dr. Adrian Walton is helping to find Frank a forever home.
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Walton here. I'm reaching out to all of our followers as well as the reptile community.
In a video on Facebook, Walton says his team has not been able to find Frank's owner, and they think he was dumped in the field. The good news is...
he appears to be healthy other than some evidence of shell rot that seems to be resolving.
But there's one major thing to take into consideration. Walton says Frank is actually still a young guy, and could easily quadruple in weight to 200 pounds, reaching the size of a wheelbarrow. And sulcata tortoises like Frank can live for more than 100 years, which makes finding someone to take care of him a bit tricky. So if you're interested, make sure you're in it for the long haul. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The war between Hamas and Israel is playing out in vivid, real-time detail online, but social media sites are full of misinformation and outright incitement. Navigating the digital information war, that's ahead. You're listening to The World. The hunt for stolen cultural artifacts. International police and the United Nations are teaming up, and they're getting some outside help.
Well, we are working with some enterprises that normally works in video games.
A new virtual museum full of missing cultural treasures from around the globe. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A consistent feature of conflict in the modern era is the information war that takes place online. Social media has an endless stream of real-time information, and we're seeing that stream turn into a torrent right now with the fighting between Hamas and Israel. But caveat emptor, there's also misinformation, fake imagery of dead civilians, and extreme examples of hatred against Jews and Muslims. This can serve to further inflame anger and frustration. To find out what can be done to combat this and at the same time stay well informed on what's going on, we turn to Imran Ahmad. He's founder and CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate and joins us from Washington. Imran, can you give us some examples of the kind of misinformation that you've been seeing online connected to the war in the Middle East?
Well, look, there's such a slew of disinformation, it's difficult to find any one particular theme, but there are four major types of bad actors producing disinformation and hate content. You've got hostile states, you've got extremist groups, both foreign and domestic. You've got people who are literally what we call engagement farmers, who are people who just put out lots of content. It can be recycled content, it can be fake, it can be real, but what they're really looking for is clicks so they can grow their following and they can monetize them. And then you've also got people who just like causing pain, like causing chaos.
Right, and it's not just a vulnerability of online spaces. We've seen misinformation that starts offline and then goes viral when it lands in social media, right?
Yeah, I mean, the offline world and the online world are the same world. They're our world. It's people that populate them. And so people who are chronically misinformed by any source, or people who are seeking to create, you know, information disorder, they're using every means at their disposal to do so.
What about outright fake videos or images? Have you seen photos from this conflict that have been determined to be altered or even generated maybe by AI?
We've seen some alteration of images. We've seen the recycling of images from 5 years ago, or from 5,000 miles away, which are being used in this conflict. But generative AI, you're absolutely right to flag it, because that just contributes to the diminishment of trust in what we can see and hear on these platforms. I mean, you don't know anymore whether or not something is just invented. It's bits and bytes rather than flesh and blood that you're looking at.
There's also plenty of hatred in this current climate. Online right now, Muslims and Jews are reporting instances of incitement and bigotry. How bad is it?
I mean, it's the worst I've ever seen it. And, you know, I am genuinely scared for our ability to sustain healthy, cohesive communities if there is such a slew of content which is seeking to divide us. And I think that, you know, in peacetime, so to speak, you see the drip, drip of disinformation that underpins hatred. And disinformation and hatred are inherently intertwined, that you can't separate the two, because all hate is based upon lies. Take, for example, with anti-Semitism, from 2,000 years ago, you've got the blood libel to the Nazi regime using the protocols of the Elders of Zion, to today, the great replacement theory. It's always lies and conspiracy theories that underpin hate.
What are the responsibilities of social media companies then? Like, what should X, the former Twitter or TikTok, Instagram, what should they be doing to make sure they're not adding fuel to these fires of hate?
Look, I mean, social media companies have been sacking trust and safety staff in the last year.
Laying them off,
and
yeah.
You have this extraordinary situation where they're benefiting from the attention being generated by conspiracism and hate, because where do people then go to argue about the conspiracism and hate that they see on their platforms, consuming ads all the time, which makes them money? Mark Zuckerberg is personally worth $100 billion. Surely he can spend a tiny bit to actually make his platform a less toxic, disinforming, and dangerous place.
I'm constantly surprised by the extent to which people get their news from social media. So until, you know, that investment is made by the social media companies, what exactly do we as social media users do about this?
When I switched on social media at the start of this conflict, as I have at the start of every major news event in the past 10, 15 years, it was almost unintelligible. You know, what you have is disinformation intermingling seamlessly with good information. But the problem is that trying to tell them apart, trying to work out what is what, is near impossible to do in a short period of time. Or you could do what I did in the end, which is I switched off my phone, I switched on the television, and I went and saw what was on the news, because at least then I know that it's fact-checked, that it's timely, and that it's well-curated.
Of course, a lot of information that is shared online is very real, and social media has long been a place where certain voices and perspectives can successfully reach a wider audience. How do we make sure that remains the case while also countering the spread of misinformation?
Well, we do it by countering the spread of misinformation. The problem is that when you have an information environment in which good information intermingles seamlessly with bad information, and where the advent of generative AI means that you can't even trust what you see anymore, that disadvantages those people who are trying to tell the truth.
Imran, given your work, I guess you have to look at social media, but I mean, do you basically try to unplug when you're not doing your research?
Look, in the last week, I've seen more dead children than I care to see for the rest of my life. And I'm sure a lot of other people have seen that sort of content on there. It is vital to unplug. It's vital to take those breaks. The world is a bright, beautiful place full of people who generally want to get on. And it is really important that we aren't plugged into these environments that are designed to addict us by putting us in a constant state of anxiety.
Imran Ahmad is the founder and CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate. He joined us from Washington. Thank you so much for your time and for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Yvette Masoudi grew up in the suburbs of Los Angeles with her adoptive parents, but she says her heart was in Iran, the birthplace of her biological father.
I always wanted to find my people, even though I love the people I grew up with. So I spent most of my life looking for my roots, basically.
That set Masoudi on a journey of discovery into Iranian pop music from the 1970s. The world's Shirin Jafari spoke with Masoudi and brings us the story.
That LA suburb where Masoudi grew up was a dream.
Because it was a Black, Latino, Chicano, Southeast Asian, Pacific Islander. Everybody was there, except there were no Iranians and there were no Middle Easterners at that time.
That time in the 1970s was before the Islamic Revolution would uproot Iranians from their homeland and send them all the way to California. When that did happen, it didn't make life any easier for Massoudi. The revolutionaries took 52 American diplomats hostage. Iran was all over the news for the wrong reasons.
I was started to really be harassed by kids in school, so my mother told me to stop telling people I was Iranian.
It was hard following that advice, she says, to hide her identity. Massoudi's questions about her biological father and her Iranian roots followed her through the 1990s when she stumbled upon a website created by Iranian expats. It was called Iranian.com.
And it was amazing because I could read all these beautiful family stories, poetry, heartbreaking stories, people searching for lost family members and friends.
And nostalgic videos of old pop star performances from a 1970s TV show called Rangarang.
I fell in love with it. I just thought they were amazing because I grew up loving American variety TV shows, and these videos reminded me of those, except they were Persian. And the music is a combination of many cultures. It's definitely Persian, but you can hear influences from around the world in it.
Massoudi tried to sing along with them, but she couldn't. She didn't speak Persian, so instead she would just mimic the sound. This turned out to be the starting point of a career in music inspired by old Persian pop songs. Massoudi went on to learn Persian, and now she incorporates these songs into her music. Her latest song is called Shikar Ahu, or Deer Hunting. It's the story of a man who's about to go deer hunting and is talking about it with his love, Leili. But there's a dark side to the story. Leili ends up killing him and using his blood to write a letter.
Such great drama. And what I find fascinating about that is he's using that as a way to describe her cruelty in a sense, because she's probably not really paying attention to him very much.
The story of the deer hunter was haunting, Massoudi explains, but there was something else that added to the intensity. As she was recording the song, massive anti-government protests were sweeping Iran. They were in response to the death in police custody of a young woman called Mahsa Jina Amini. Massoudi wanted her music to reflect that moment of despair for so many women in Iran.
It's very intense emotionally, and I didn't want to just sing it as a straight ahead folk song. I wanted to bring a little more of a darker feeling to it.
Massoudi's music draws particular inspiration from women pop singers in Iran in the 70s. She says that's because she wants to point to a time when women there had much more freedom.
There was a time when women were leading bands. Women could sing as soloists. And they were hugely popular. They didn't have to suffer for that position. They were rewarded. They were encouraged.
Today, women singers in Iran can only perform to all-female audiences and in private, or if they're part of a group.
So we're changing it up a little bit, but it's still a reminder that it hasn't always been this way in Iran.
Ivad Massoudi's new single, Deer Hunting, is out tomorrow. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
We've heard a lot in recent years about cultural artifacts taken from their rightful owners and sources. Think figurines from ancient temples in Asia or priceless pieces of art looted from war zones. Interpol, the international policing agency, has a database of some 52,000 cultural artifacts that were stolen or trafficked. It's now working with UNESCO to gradually put them on virtual display in an online museum that will go live in 2025. The idea is that showing 3D images of these stolen cultural treasures could help lead to their recovery. Ernesto Ottone is UNESCO's Assistant Director General for Culture. He told me what an online visitor to this virtual museum is likely to encounter.
You're going to enter in a virtual space. You're going to go through exhibitions of those objects where you're going to be able to understand the stories, where they come from, how to implement programs, educational programs around those objects, and explain how they are related with the countries or the region where they were stolen from, and how to help all the authorities that today are working to recover these illicit trafficked pieces of artworks and artifacts, to give the information to authorities so that we can recover all this.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So how do you do that? You've got, in many cases, I imagine, just a two-dimensional image, a flat image, and you want people to see when they go online the actual three-dimensional kind of quality of this object. How are you going to do that?
Well, we are working with some enterprises that normally works in video games and that have the technology to transform a 2D image in something live, something real. Because what you have in the database is the date, where it comes from, when it was stolen, and a very little image that was in the inventories of those museums. We are talking Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, all around the world, and especially also in Africa, Latin America, and some countries of Asia.
So in 2025, 600 of these items will be on display. What are some of those cultural objects that we'll be able to see in this virtual museum?
For this, we want to do, as we do it always at UNESCO, that we have a representation geographically very balanced so that we can show that this illegal trafficking is affecting every country around the world. And we need to tackle it together. It's the only way to do it, with custom officers, with the policemen, with the legislation in all countries, so that we can ensure that we are tackling the problem from the origin of the stolen objects.
So even though this is all virtual and online, you're taking the concept of museum quite literally, getting an architect to design a museum, even though, again, it's all online. You've chosen Pritzker Prize-winning architect Francis Kéré of Burkina Faso to design this online museum. What does he bring to this project?
He was so embedded with the meaning of an object that has lost his identity because it was stolen, it was cut from the root of this tree, that he says, I will embark in this project. I will put all my knowledge in trying to understand and to build a museum that looks like not a museum, but the most important is how I build the connection between all the countries and all the regions where it's affecting the social cohesion, because artifacts, museums represent social cohesion in all our countries. And today, when you see that an object has been stolen, it means that somebody is hurting Earth, is hurting the identity of our community.
And I understand Interpol has a database of 52,000 items. Is the idea to eventually have a 3D representation of all of them?
Well, it will be our dream, but it's very difficult because we have many stolen objects where we don't have any picture. So what we have to rely on is on the scientific description of those objects. And as you know, many times when we have objects that are in some countries detained at the custom office of the country, the problem is that you have the country of origin have to have experts that goes to the other place to verify if this object is the same that was stolen. When you don't have any picture or any description of this object, it's very difficult to say that it's the same object that was stolen, or that it belongs to other collections and there is no illicit trafficking.
Is Interpol's database of stolen objects constantly growing, or is there just a kind of a regular discovery and return of them?
So yes, every day it's growing, but at the same time, only last year, in 2022, there was the recovery of more than 50,000 stolen objects around the world. But you have to know that, yes, it's growing, but also recovery is also going in the right direction.
I'm curious, are you sensing that there is a greater willingness among those in possession of stolen objects to return them these days?
We have been participating in the last 2 years in many return and restitution from private citizens, but also governments, auction houses. And also today we are working with the virtual platforms. They are putting banners when they have the feeling that these objects have been participating in illicit trafficking to ensure that those objects cannot be sold via web pages. So yes.
Ernesto Otone is UNESCO's Assistant Director General for Culture. He's been speaking with us about a virtual museum of stolen cultural artifacts that UNESCO and Interpol are creating to help raise awareness of the theft of cultural property. Ernesto spoke to us from Paris. Thank you very much. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you.
The videos are incredible. Giant slabs of icebergs calving and crashing into the water below. It is a powerful testament to the climate change we are living through. What's more difficult to measure, though, is just how rapidly these giant chunks of ice are melting and what that means for the world's oceans. That's where our next guest comes in. Hanumant Singh is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Northeastern University. He helped create an autonomous surface vehicle, kind of ocean-going robot that's able to map and measure water that's too shallow or turbulent for underwater vehicles. So, Hanu, this vehicle is called Jet Yak, just 11 feet long, kind of like a motorized kayak, it seems. What does it have on board for gathering data?
This robot is essentially a kayak. It has a lawnmower engine on it. And so it's a little gasoline-powered kayak that we've instrumented with a bunch of instruments so that we can make these measurements right in front of these calving glaciers.
So as I understand it, you're using the data gathered by the Jet Yak to create detailed 3D maps of icebergs off of Greenland. What are you learning from those maps?
What people are doing when they're trying to understand climate change is trying to model how these icebergs are bringing fresh water into the world's oceans, how they're affecting the melt rate of Greenland. And so what we were trying to do is say, can we make really precise measurements of these icebergs and their melt rate? And then if we can, then hopefully what we will be able to do is correlate what we see from the satellite pictures and the images to what we're actually seeing on the ground and come up with much more accurate models of what's happening with the iceberg melt.
So are you able to say at this point what you've discovered exactly about how fast the icebergs are melting?
So I have to preface this by saying I'm not a glaciologist. I'm not a physical oceanographer. I'm an engineer. But what I can tell you is, when we started making these measurements, one of the really hard problems in robotics is to make measurements on ice and snow because there's very little texture, unlike, say, in a home with a home robot. And so that's why we were very interested in this problem from a purely robotic standpoint as well. So that's what made us, excited about this whole thing. We have a way of doing it that's reasonably fast, cheap, and seems to be getting good results.
The Jet Yak is pretty small. How long can it stay out there on any given voyage?
So, the interesting thing with robots is gasoline has almost an order of magnitude more energy density than, say, lithium-ion batteries. And so, that's why, unfortunately, we can't kick our fossil fuel habit. That's why we can't build planes that fly on lithium-ion batteries. So because it was powered by gasoline, it can do 20 hours. And more importantly, it can actually go fast. So when we're near melting glaciers as opposed to icebergs, there's a huge outflow. And a lot of our instruments get blown away because the current is 7, 8, 9 knots. And so because it's got this energy density with gasoline, not only can it stay there for a long period of time, but it can handle these high speeds and actually work in those environments.
And if you suspect a glacier is about to calve, can you get that Jet Yak out of there before it gets destroyed?
So, there's lots of funny stories about that. The first time we went out there, we saw a big chunk of ice falling, and we were about 500 meters away as we were, driving it remotely. And the first reaction is, oh my God, what are we going to do? It's going to fall right on top of it. And we try and turn the jet yak around and try and get out of that. But the reality is, when a big chunk of ice falls, these glaciers are in fjords that are very deep. And the effect in deep water, unless something falls directly on you, is very small. It's like a tsunami. When it's out in the open ocean, you'll only see a small change in the overall depth and a very small wave going by you. The real effects you feel are actually on shore when all that water suddenly goes way up the shore and forms these crashing waves. So the Jet Yak was fine because it was in deep water. However, our campsite, 5 kilometers down the fjord, saw the waves.
And is someone essentially driving or operating the Jet Yak remotely, or is it truly on its own?
We can do it both ways. We can make it autonomous, whether it's completely on its own. But typically, we're driving it. We're driving it from a safe distance. You know, we're trying to do with these robots stuff that's dull, dirty, dangerous data that we can't get any other way. And that's what's kind of neat about it.
Can the jet yak be used also in Antarctica, where we know there's a lot of concern about ice melt?
So the interesting issues are, we use the jet yak for lots of other things, right? We've used it in the Arctic when it's springtime. We've used it to see what happens after Hurricane Sandy in New York. How did the sediments all change?
2012.
Yeah. So we can use it in a lot of environments. Antarctica is a different issue, basically, because a lot of ice in Antarctica is landfast, right? It's sitting on land. And so we don't quite use it there. Its optimum use is probably places like Greenland, where there's a deep fjord, and you can drive in the fjord right up to a water terminating glacier.
How many jet yaks are there out there, or do you just have one that you take around to different locations?
We built the first one, and it was originally built for trying to understand how sediment is transported. Then we built this other one to go up and look at glaciers. And then there was a company formed, and I believe at last count, there's 30 or 40 of them that are doing all sorts of things. Wow. There's a chem yak, there's an ice yak, there's a jet yak. And the great thing about it is that it's something that's easy to build and hand to a scientist, and they can easily use it for their own purposes.
Hanu, you've seen calving in person. I'm sure you've also seen the videos, often tourists waiting to see an iceberg break apart. It's like a building falling over, super dramatic. You hear the oohs and ahs. What do you feel, though, when you see those events?
There's two parts to it. One part is Greenland, the Arctic, the Antarctic are the most beautiful places on the planet. And we've done all sorts of applications completely independent of the jet yak. You know, unmanned aerial systems, looked at penguin colonies. We've taken our underwater vehicles under sea ice to look at all that. It's the most beautiful part of this planet, as far as I'm concerned. Having said that, the tragedy is we are building these instruments. A great example was we wanted to look at invasive crab species moving up the coast in Antarctica. Well, the instrument works really well, but the news is all bad. Yes, we found those invasive crab species. Oh, by the way, yes, because of climate change, they are climbing up the coast in Antarctica, and they're going to wreak havoc in the ecosystem there. Sea ice is melting faster than we thought, and there's so much meltwater. The native people in Greenland are really suffering because of these events. You know, it feels good to be able to bring instrumentation to bear on these important problems and actually have those instruments work. It's kind of sad in a way to see that every time we look at a hypothesis, these instruments are proving it true again and again, and the effects of climate change are kind of staggering.
Hanumant Singh is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Northeastern University. Thank you very much, Hanu. Great to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and thank you for listening.